information I could use.
I might, Card said.
Do you have enough money to pay for it?
Knowing your prices, probably not, Luke said. But I could set you up a credit line when I get back.
If you get back, Card countered. Considering how many Imperial troops there are between you and safe territory, you're not what I would call a good investment risk at the moment.
Luke cocked an eyebrow at him.
As opposed to a smuggler at the top of the Empire's locate and detain list? He asked pointedly.
Card smiled.
As it happens, Callias is one of the few places in Imperial space where I'm perfectly safe. The Burchestian governor and I have known each other for several years. More to the point, there are certain items important to him which only I can supply.
Military items?
I'm not part of your war, Skywalker.
Card reminded him coolly.
I'm neutral, and I intend to stay that way. I thought I'd made that clear to you and your sister when we last parted company.
Oh, it was clear enough, Luke agreed. I just thought that the events of the past month might have changed your mind.
Card's expression didn't change, but Luke could detect the almost unwilling shift in his sense.
I don't particularly like the idea of Grand Admiral Thrawn having access to a cloning facility, he conceded. It has the long-term potential for shifting the balance of power in his favor, and that's something neither of us wants to see happen. But I think your side is rather overreacting to the situation.
I don't know how you can call it overreacting, Luke said. The Empire has most of the 200 dreadnoughts of the Katana fleet, and now they've got an unlimited supply of clones to crew them with.
Unlimited is hardly the word I would use, Card said. Clones can only be grown so quickly if you want them mentally stable enough to trust with your warships. 1 year minimum per clone, as I recall the old rule of thumb.
A group of 5 Vathkri passed by in front of them along a cross street. So far, the Empire had been only cloning humans, but Luke checked them out anyway.
Again, nothing.
1 year per clone, you say?
At the absolute minimum, Card said. The pre-Clone Wars documents I've seen suggest 3 to 5 years would be a more appropriate period. Quicker than the standard human growth cycle, certainly, but hardly any reason for panic.
Luke looked up at the carved towers, their sunlit red-orange in sharp contrast to the billowing white clouds rolling in from the sea behind them. What would you say if I told you the clones who attacked us on the Katana were grown in less than 1 year?
Card shrugged.
And that depends on how much less.
The full cycle was 15 to 20 days.
Card stopped short.
What?
He demanded, turning to stare at Luke.
15 to 20 days,
Luke repeated, stopping beside him. For a long moment, Card locked eyes with him.
Then slowly he turned away and began walking again.
That's impossible, he said. There must be an error.
I can get you a copy of the studies.
Card nodded thoughtfully, his eyes focused on nothing in particular.
At least that explains Yukio.
Yukio?
Luke frowned. Card glanced at him.
That's right. You've probably been out of touch for a while. 2 days ago, the Imperials launched a multiple attack on targets in the Abrian and Dufilvian sectors. They severely damaged the military base at Ord Pardren and captured the Yukio system.
Luke felt a hollow sensation in his stomach. Yukio was one of the top 5 producers of foodstuffs in the entire New Republic. The repercussions for Abrion sector alone.
How badly was Yukio damaged?
Apparently not at all, Card said. My sources tell me it was taken with its shields and ground space weaponry intact.
The hollow feeling got a little bigger.
I thought that was impossible to do.
A knack for doing the impossible was one of the things Grand Admirals were selected for,
Card said dryly.
Details of the attack are still sketchy. It'll be interesting to see how he pulled it off.
So Thrawn had the Katana dreadnoughts, and he had clones to man them with. And now he had the ability to provide food for those clones. This isn't just the setup to another series of raids, Luke said slowly. The Empire is getting ready to launch a major offensive.
It does begin to look that way, Card agreed. Offhand, I'd say you have your work cut out for you.
Luke studied him. Card's voice and face were as calm as ever, but the sense behind them wasn't nearly so certain anymore.
And none of this changes your mind? He prompted the other.
I'm not joining the New Republic, Skywalker, Card said, shaking his head. For many reasons, not the least being that I don't entirely trust certain elements in your government.
I think Phalia's been pretty well discredited.
I wasn't referring only to Phalia, Card cut him off. You know as well as I do how fond the Mon Calamari have always been of smugglers. Now that Admiral Akbar has been reinstated to his council and supreme commander positions, all of us in the trade are going to have to start watching over our shoulders again.
Oh, come on, Luke snorted. You don't think Akbar is going to have time to worry about smugglers, do you?
Card smiled wryly.
Not really, but I'm not willing to risk my life on it either.
Stalemate. All right, then, Luke said. Let's put it on a strictly business level. We need to know the Empire's movements and intentions, which is something you probably keep track of anyway. Can we buy that information from you?
Card considered.
That might be possible, he said cautiously. But only if I have the final say on what I pass on to you. I won't have you turning my group into an unofficial arm of New Republic intelligence.
Agreed, Luke said.
It was less than he might have hoped for, but it was better than nothing.
I'll set up a credit line for you as soon as I get back.
Perhaps we shall start with a straight information trade, Card said, looking around at the crystalline buildings. Tell me what started your people looking at Calais.
I'll do better than that, Luke said. The distant touch on his mind was faint, but unmistakable. How about if I confirm the clones are here?
Where? Card asked sharply.
Somewhere that way,
Luke said, pointing ahead and slightly to the right.
Half a kilometer away, maybe. It's hard to tell.
Inside one of the towers, Card decided. Nice and secure, and well hidden from prying eyes. I wonder if there's any way to get inside for a look.
Wait a minute. They're moving,
Luke said, frowning as he tried to hang on to the contact.
Heading almost toward us, but not quite.
Probably being taken to the landing field,
Card said. He glanced around, pointed to the right.
They'll probably use Maverick Street, 2 blocks that direction.
Balancing speed with the need to remain inconspicuous, they covered the distance in 3 minutes.
They'll probably use a cargo carrier or light transport,
Card said, as they found a spot where they could watch the street without being run over by the pedestrian traffic along the edges of the vehicle way.
Anything obviously military would attract attention.
Luke nodded. Maverill, he remembered from the maps, was one of the handful of streets in Calais that had been carved large enough for vehicles to use, with the result that the traffic was running pretty much fore to aft.
I wish I had some macro binoculars with me, he commented.
Trust me, you're conspicuous enough as it is,
Card countered as he craned his neck over the passing crowds.
Any sign of them? They're definitely coming this way, Luke told him. He reached out with the Force,
trying to sort out the clone sense from the sandstorm of other thoughts and minds surrounding him.
I guess 20 to 30 of them.
A cargo carrier, then, Card decided. There's one coming now, just behind that Trask speeder truck.
I see it.
Luke took a deep breath, calling on every bit of his Jedi skill.
That's them, he murmured, a shiver running up his back.
All right,
Card said, his voice grim.
Watch closely. They might have left one or more of the ventilation panels open.
The cargo carrier made its way toward them on its repulsor lens, coming abruptly to a halt a short block away as the driver of the speeder truck in front of it suddenly woke up to the fact that he'd reached his turn. Gingerly, the truck eased around the corner, blocking the whole traffic flow behind it.
"Wait here,"
Card said, and dived into the stream of pedestrians heading that direction. Luke kept his eyes sweeping the area, alert for any sense that he or Card had been seen and recognized. If this whole setup was some kind of elaborate trap for off-world spies, now would be the obvious time to spring it. The truck finally finished its turn, and the cargo carrier lumbered on. It passed Luke and continued down the street, disappearing within a few seconds around one of the red-orange buildings. Stepping back into the side street behind him, Luke waited, and a minute later, Card had returned.
"Two of the vents were open, but I couldn't see enough to be sure,"
he told Luke, breathing heavily.
"You?"
Luke shook his head. "I couldn't see anything either, but it was them. I'm sure of it." For a moment, Card studied his face. Then he gave a curt nod.
"All right. What now?"
"I'm going to see if I can get my ship off planet ahead of them," Luke said. "If I can track their hyperspace vector, maybe we can figure out where they go from here." He lifted his eyebrows. "Though two ships working together could do a better track." Card smiled slightly.
"You'll forgive me if I decline the offer," he said. "Flying in tandem with a New Republic agent is not exactly what I would call maintaining neutrality."
He glanced over Luke's shoulder at the street behind him.
"At any rate, I think I'd prefer to try backtracking them from here. See if I can identify their point of origin."
"Sounds good," Luke nodded. "I'd better get over to the landing field and get my ship prepped."
"I'll be in touch," Card promised.
"Make sure that credit line is a generous one."
Standing at the uppermost window of Central Government Tower Number 1, Governor Staffa lowered his macro binoculars with a satisfied snort.
"That was him, all right, Fingo,"
he said to the little man hovering at his side.
"No doubt about it. Luke Skywalker himself."
"Do you suppose he saw the special transport?"
Fingal asked, fingering his own macro binoculars nervously.
"Well, of course he saw it," Staffa
growled.
"You think he was hanging around Mavro Street for his health?"
"I only thought..."
"Don't think, Fingal,"
Staffa cut him off.
"You aren't properly equipped for it."
He sauntered to his desk, dropped the macro binoculars into a drawer, and pulled up Grand Admiral Thrawn's directive on his datapad. It was a rather bizarre directive, in his private and strictly confidential opinion, more peculiar even than these mysterious troop transfers the Imperial High Command had been running through Callius of late. But one had no choice under the circumstances but to assume Thrawn knew what he was doing. At any rate, it was on his own head, not Staffa's, if he didn't, and that was the important thing.
"I want you to send a message to the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera,"
he told Fingal, lowering his bulk carefully into his chair and pushing the datapad across the desk.
"Coded as per the instructions here, inform Grand Admiral Thrawn that Skywalker has been on Callias, and that I have personally observed him near the special transport. Also, as per the Grand Admiral's directive, he has been allowed to leave Burchest unhindered."
"Yes, Governor,"
Fingal said, making notes on his own datapad. If the little man saw anything unusual about letting a rebel spy walk freely through Imperial territory, he wasn't showing it.
"What about the other man, Governor? The one who is with Skywalker down there?"
Staffa pursed his lips. The price on Talon Card's head was up to nearly 50,000 now. A great deal of money, even for a man with a planetary governor's salary and perks. He had always known that someday it would be in his best interest to terminate the quiet business relationship he had with Card. Perhaps that time had finally come. No. No, not while war still raged through the galaxy. Later, perhaps, when victory was near and private supply lines could be made more reliable. But not now.
"The other man is of no importance,"
he told Fingal.
A special agent I sent to help smoke the rebel spy into the open. Forget him. Go on. Get that message coded and sent.
Yes, sir.
Fingal nodded, stepping toward the door. The panel slid open, and for just a second, as Fingal stepped through, Staffa thought he saw an odd glint in the little man's eye. Some strange trick of the outer office light, of course. Next to his unbending loyalty for his governor, Fingal's most prominent and endearing attribute was his equally unbending lack of imagination. Taking a deep breath, putting Fingal and rebel spies and even grand admirals out of his mind, Staffa leaned back in his chair and began to consider how he would use the shipment that Card's people were even now unloading at the landing field. Chapter 3. Slowly, as if climbing a long, dark staircase, Mara Jade pulled herself out of a deep sleep. She opened her eyes, looked around the softly lit room, and wondered where in the galaxy she was. It was a medical area. That much was obvious from the biomonitors, the folded room dividers, and the other multi-position beds scattered around the one she was lying in. But it wasn't one of Card's facilities, at least not one she was familiar with. But the layout itself was all too familiar. It was a standard Imperial recovery room. For the moment, she seemed to be alone, but she knew that wouldn't last. Silently, she rolled out of bed into a crouching position on the floor, taking a quick inventory of her physical condition as she did so. No aches or pains. No dizziness or obvious injuries. Slipping into the robe and bedshoes at the end of the bed, she padded silently to the door, preparing herself mentally to silence or disable whatever was out there. She waved at the door release, and as the panel slid open, she leaped through into the recovery anteroom and came to a sudden, slightly disoriented halt.
Oh, hi, Mara,
Gent said distractedly, glancing up from the computer terminal he was hunched over before returning his attention to it.
How are you feeling?
Not too bad,
Mara said, staring at the kid and sifting furiously through a set of hazy memories. Gent, one of Card's employees, and possibly the best slicer in the galaxy. And the fact that he was sitting at a terminal meant they weren't prisoners, unless their captor was so abysmally stupid that he didn't know better than to let a slicer get within spitting distance of a computer. But hadn't she sent Gent to the New Republic headquarters on Coruscant? Yes, she had. On Card's instructions, just before collecting some of his group together and leading them into that melee at the Katana fleet, where she'd run her Z-95 up against an Imperial Star Destroyer and had had to eject, and had brilliantly arranged to fly her ejector seat straight through an ion cannon beam, which had fried her survival equipment and set her drifting, lost forever in interstellar space. She looked around her. Apparently forever hadn't lasted as long as she'd expected it to.
Where are we?
She asked, though she had a pretty good idea now what the answer would be. She was right.
The old Imperial Palace on Coruscant,
Gent told her, frowning a little.
Medical wing. They had to do some reconstruction on your neural pathways. Don't you remember?
It's a little vague, Mara admitted.
But as the last cobwebs cleared from her brain, the rest of it was beginning to fall into place. Her ejector seat's ruined life support system, and a strange lightheaded vagueness as she drifted off to sleep in the darkness. She'd probably suffered oxygen deprivation before they'd been able to locate her and get her to a ship. No, not they. Him. There was only one person who could possibly have found a single crippled ejector seat in all the emptiness and battle debris out there. Luke Skywalker. The last of the Jedi Knights. The man she was going to kill.
You will kill Luke Skywalker!
She took a step back to lean against the door jamb, knees suddenly feeling weak, as the Emperor's words echoed through her mind. She'd been here, on this world, and in this building, where he'd died over Endor. Had watched through his mind as Luke Skywalker cut him down and brought her life crashing in ruins around her head.
"I see you're awake," a new voice said.
Mara opened her eyes. The newcomer, a middle-aged woman in a duty medic's tunic, was marching briskly across the room toward her from a far door, an MD droid trailing in her wake.
"How are you feeling?"
"I'm fine," Mara said, feeling a sudden urge to lash out at the other woman. These people, these enemies of the Empire, had no right to be here in the Emperor's palace. She took a careful breath, fighting back the flash of emotion. The medic had stopped short, a professional frown on her face. Gent, his cherished computers momentarily forgotten, and a puzzled look on his.
"Sorry," she muttered. "I guess I'm still a little disoriented."
"Understandable," the medic nodded. "You've been lying in that bed for a month, after all."
Mara stared at her.
"A month?"
"Well, most of a month,"
the medic corrected herself.
"You also spent some time in a Bacta tank. Don't worry, short-term memory problems are common during neural reconstructions, but they nearly always clear up after the treatment."
"I understand," Mara said mechanically. "A month. She'd lost a whole month here. And in that time..."
"We have a guest suite arranged for you upstairs whenever you feel ready to leave here,"
the medic continued.
"Would you like me to see if it's ready?"
Mara focused on her.
"That would be fine," she said.
The medic pulled out a comlink and thumbed it on, and as she began talking, Mara stepped past her to Gent's side.
"What's been happening with the war during the last month?"
she asked him.
"Oh, the Empire's been making the usual trouble,"
Gent said, waving toward the sky.
"They've got the folks here pretty stirred up anyway. Akbar and Maydeen and the rest have been running around like crazy, trying to push him back or cut him off. Something like that."
And that was, Mara knew, all she would get out of him on the subject of current events. Aside from a fascination with smuggler folklore, the only thing that really mattered to Gent was slicing at computers. She frowned, belatedly remembering why Card had ordered Gent here in the first place.
"Wait a minute," she said. "Akbar's back in command? You mean you've cleared him already?"
"Sure,"
Gent said.
"That suspicious bank deposit thing Counselor Phalia made such a fuss over was a complete fraud. The guys who did that electronic break-in at the bank planted it in his account at the same time. Probably Imperial Intelligence. It had their nose prints all over the programming. Oh, sure. I proved that 2 days after I got here."
"I imagine they were pleased. So why are you still here?"
"Well..."
For a moment, Gent seemed taken aback.
"No one's come back to get me, for one thing."
His face brightened.
"Besides, there's this really neat encrypt code someone nearby is using to send information to the Empire. General Bel Iblis says the Imperials call it Delta Source, and it's sending them stuff right out of the palace."
"And he asked you to slice it for them,"
Mara nodded, feeling her lip twist.
"I don't suppose he offered to pay you or anything."
"Well..."
Gent shrugged.
"Probably they did. I don't remember, really."
The medic replaced her comlink in her belt.
"Your guide will be here momentarily," she told Mara.
"Thank you,"
Mara said, resisting the urge to tell the other that she probably knew the Imperial Palace better in her sleep than any guide they had could do in broad daylight.
Cooperation and politeness, those were the keys to talking them out of a ship and getting her and Gent out of this place and out of their war.
Behind the medic, the door slid open, and a tall woman with pure white hair glided into the room.
"Hello, Mara,"
she said, smiling gravely.
"My name is Winter, personal aide to Princess Leia Organa Solo. I'm glad to see you on your feet again."
"I'm glad to be there,"
Mara said, trying to keep her voice polite. Someone else associated with Skywalker, just what she needed.
"I take it you're my guide?"
"Your guide, your assistant, and anything else you need for the next few days,"
Winter said.
"Princess Leia asked me to look after you until she and Captain Solo return from Pilva."
"I don't need an assistant, and I don't need looking after,"
Mara said.
All I really need is a ship. I've already started working on that,
Winter said.
I'm hoping we'll be able to find something for you soon. In the meantime, may I show you to your suite?
Mara hid a grimace. The usurpers of the New Republic, graciously offering her hospitality in what had once been her own home.
That's very kind of you,
she said, trying not to sound sarcastic.
You coming, Ghent? You go on ahead,
Ghent said absently, gazing at the computer display.
I want to sit on this run for a while. You'll be all right here,
Winter assured her.
This way, please.
They left the anteroom, and Winter led the way toward the rear of the palace.
Ghent has a suite right next to yours,
Winter commented as they walked.
But I don't think he's been there more than twice in the past month. He set up temporary shop out there in the recovery anteroom, where he could keep an eye on you.
Mara had to smile at that. Ghent, who spent roughly 90% of his waking hours oblivious to the outside world, was not exactly what she would go looking for in either a nurse or a bodyguard. But it was the thought that counted.
I appreciate you people taking care of me,
she told Winter.
It was the least we could do to thank you for coming to our assistance at the Katana battle. It was Card's idea,
Mara said shortly.
Thank him, not me. We did,
Winter said.
But you risked your life too, on our behalf. We won't forget that.
Mara threw a sideways look at the white-haired woman. She had read the Emperor's files on the rebellion's leaders, including Leia Organa, and the name Winter wasn't ringing any bells at all.
How long have you been with Organa Solo?
She asked.
I grew up with her in the royal court of Alderaan,
Winter said, a bittersweet smile touching her lips.
We were friends in childhood, and when she began her first steps into galactic politics, her father assigned me to be her aide. I've been with her ever since. I don't recall hearing about you during the height of the rebellion,
Mara probed gently.
I spent most of the war moving from planet to planet, working with supply and procurement,
Winter told her.
If my colleagues could get me into a warehouse or depot on some pretext, I could draw a map for them of where the items were they wanted. It made the subsequent raids quicker and safer.
Mara nodded as understanding came.
So you were the one called Targeter, the one with the perfect memory.
Winter's forehead creased slightly.
Yes, that was one of my code names,
she said.
I had many others over the years. I see, Mara said.
She could remember a fair number of references in pre-Yavin intelligence reports to the mysterious rebel named Targeter. Much of the politely heated discussion centering around his or her possible identity. She wondered if the data pushers had ever even gotten close. They'd reached the set of turbolifts at the rear of the Imperial Palace now, one of the major renovations the Emperor had made in the deliberately antiquated design of the building when he'd taken it over. The turbolifts saved a lot of walking up and down the sweeping staircases in the more public parts of the building, as well as masking certain other improvements the Emperor had made in the palace.
So what's the problem with getting me a ship?
Mara asked, as Winter tapped the call plate.
The problem is the Empire,
Winter said.
They've launched a massive attack against us, and it's tied up basically everything we have available, from light freighter on up.
Mara frowned. Massive attacks against superior forces didn't sound like Grand Admiral Thrawn at all.
It's that bad? It's bad enough,
Winter said.
I don't know if you knew it, but they beat us to the Katana fleet. They'd already moved nearly 180 of the dreadnoughts by the time we arrived. Combined with their new bottomless source of crewers and soldiers, the balance of power has been badly shifted.
Mara nodded, a sour taste in her mouth. Put that way, it did sound like Thrawn.
Which means I nearly got myself killed for nothing.
Winter smiled tightly.
If it helps, so did a lot of other people.
The turbolift car arrived. They stepped inside, and Winter keyed for the palace's residential areas.
Ghent mentioned that the Empire was making trouble,
Mara commented as the car began moving upward.
I should have realized that anything that could penetrate that fog he walks around in had to be serious.
Serious is an understatement,
Winter said grimly.
In the past 5 days, we've effectively lost control of 4 sectors, and 13 more on the edge. The biggest loss was the food production facilities at Yukio. Somehow they managed to take it with its defenses intact.
Mara felt her lip twist. Someone asleep at the board?
Not according to the preliminary reports.
Winter hesitated.
There are rumors that the Imperials used a new superweapon that was able to fire straight through the Yukian's planetary shield. We're still trying to check that out.
Mara swallowed. Visions of the old Death Star spec sheets floating up from her memory. A weapon like that in the hands of a strategist like Grand Admiral Thrawn. She shook the thought away. This wasn't her war. Card had promised they would stay neutral in this thing.
I suppose I'd better get in touch with Card then, she said. See if he can send someone to pick us up.
It would probably be faster than waiting for one of our ships to be free,
Winter agreed.
He left a data card with the name of a contact you can send a message through. He said you'd know which encrypt code to use.
The turbolift let them out on the president's guest floor, one of the few sections of the palace that the Emperor had left strictly alone during his reign. With its old-fashioned hinge doors and hand-carved exotic wood furnishings, walking around the floor was like stepping 1,000 years into the past. The Emperor had generally reserved the suites here for those emissaries who had fond feelings for such bygone days, or for those who could be impressed by his carefully manufactured continuity with that era.
Captain Card left some of your clothes and personal effects for you after the Katana battle,
Winter said, unlocking one of the carved doors and pushing it open.
If he missed anything, let me know, and I can probably supply it. Here's the data card I mentioned,
she added, pulling it from her tunic.
Thank you,
Mara said, inhaling deeply as she took the card. This particular suite was done largely in Fijisi wood from Cartouine, and as the delicate scent rose around her, her thoughts flashed back to the glittering days of grand imperial power and majesty.
Can I get you anything else?
The memory faded. Winter was standing before her, and the glory days of the Empire were gone.
No, I'm fine,
she said. Winter nodded.
If you want anything, just call the duty officer,
she said, gesturing to the desk.
I'll be available later. Right now there's a council meeting I need to sit in on.
Go ahead, Mara said. And thank you.
Winter smiled and left. Mara took another deep breath of Fijisi wood, and with an effort, pushed the last of the lingering memories away. She was here, and it was now. And as the Emperor's instructors had so often drummed into her, the first item of business was to fit into her surroundings. And that meant not looking like an escapee from the medical wing. Card had left a good assortment of clothing for her. A semi-formal gown, 2 outfits of a nondescript type that she could wear on the streets of 100 worlds without looking out of place, and 4 of the no-nonsense tunic-slash-jumpsuit outfits that she usually wore aboard ship. Choosing one of the latter, she got dressed, then began sorting through the other things Card had left. With any luck, and maybe a little foresight on Card's part, there it was. The forearm holster for her tiny blaster. The blaster itself was missing, of course. The captain of the Adamant had taken it away from her, and the Imperials weren't likely to return it any time soon. Looking for a duplicate in the New Republic's arsenals would probably be a waste of effort as well, though she was tempted to ask Winter for one just to see the reaction. Fortunately, there was another way. Each residential floor of the Imperial Palace had an extensive library, and in each of those libraries was a multi-card set entitled The Complete History of Corvus Minor. Given how unexceptional most of Corvus Minor's history had been, the odds of anyone actually pulling the set off the shelf were extremely slim. Which, given there were no actual data cards in the box, was just as well. The blaster was a slightly different style from the one Mara had lost to the Imperials, but its power pack was still adequately charged, and it fit snugly into her forearm holster. And that was all that mattered.
Now, whatever happened with either the war or New Republic infighting, she would at least have a fighting chance. She paused, the false data card box in her hand. A stray question belatedly flicking through her mind. What had Winter meant by that reference to a bottomless source for crewers and soldiers? Had one or more of the New Republic systems gone over to the Imperial side? Or could Thrawn have discovered a hitherto unknown colony world with a populace ripe for recruitment? It was something she should probably ask about sometime. First, though, she needed to get a message encrypted and relayed out to Card's designated contact. The sooner she was out of this place, the better. Replacing the empty data card set, the comforting weight of the blaster snugged up against her left arm, she headed back to her suite. Thrawn raised his glowing red eyes from the putrid-looking alien artwork displayed on the double display ring surrounding his command chair.
"No," he said. "Completely out of the question."
Slowly, deliberately, Sabaoth turned back from the holographic woodstroid statue he'd been gazing at.
"No,"
he repeated, his voice rumbling like an approaching thunderstorm.
"What do you mean, no?"
"The word is self-explanatory," Thrawn said icily. "The military logic should be as well. We don't have the numbers for a frontal assault on Coruscant. Neither have we the supply lines and bases necessary for a traditional siege. Any attack would be both useless and wasteful, and the Empire will therefore not launch one."
Sabaoth's face darkened.
"Have a care, Grand Admiral Thrawn," he warned. "I rule the Empire, not you."
"Do you really?"
Thrawn countered, reaching up behind him to stroke the Islamir arched over his shoulder on its nutrient frame. Sabaoth drew himself up to his full height, eyes blazing with sudden fire.
"I rule the Empire,"
he shouted, his voice echoing through the command room.
"You will obey me, or you will die!"
Carefully, Pelion eased a little deeper into the force-empty bubble that surrounded Thrawn's Islamir. At those times when he was in control of himself, Sabaoth appeared more confident and in control than he ever had been before. But at the same time, these violent bursts of clone madness were becoming more frequent and more vicious. Like a system in a positive feedback loop, swinging farther from its core point with each oscillation until it ripped itself apart. So far, Sabaoth hadn't killed anyone or destroyed anything. In Pelion's opinion, it was just a matter of time before that changed. Perhaps the same thought had occurred to Thrawn.
"If you kill me, you'll lose the war," he reminded the Jedi Master. "And if you lose the war, Leia Organa Solo and her twins will never be yours."
Sabaoth took a step toward Thrawn's command seat, eyes blazing even hotter. And then, abruptly, he seemed to shrink again to normal size.
"You would never speak that way to the Emperor,"
he said almost petulantly.
"On the contrary," Thrawn told him. "On no fewer than 4 occasions, I told the Emperor that I would not waste his troops and ships attacking an enemy which I was not yet prepared to defeat."
Sabaoth snorted.
"Only fools spoke that way to the Emperor,"
he sneered.
"Fools, or those tired of life."
"The Emperor also thought that way," Thrawn agreed. "The first time I refused, he called me a traitor and gave my attack force to someone else."
The Grand Admiral reached up again to stroke his Islamir.
"After its destruction, he knew better than to ignore my recommendations."
For a long minute, Sabaoth studied Thrawn's face, his own expression twitching back and forth as if the mind behind it was having trouble maintaining a grip on thought or emotion.
"You could repeat the Yukian fraud,"
he suggested at last.
"That trick with cloaked cruisers and timed turbo laser blasts. I would help you."
"That's most generous of you," Thrawn said. "Unfortunately, that too would be a waste of effort. The rebel leaders on Coruscant wouldn't be as quick to surrender as Yukio's farm folk were.
No matter how accurate our timing, they'd eventually realize that the turbolaser blasts hitting the surface weren't the same as those fired by the Chimera, and come to the proper conclusion.
He gestured to the holographic statues filling the room.
The people and leaders of Wustri, on the other hand, are a different matter entirely. Like the Yukians, they have a strong fear of the unknown and what they perceive to be the impossible. Equally important, they have a tendency to magnify rumors of menace far out of proportion. The cloaked cruiser stratagem should work quite well there. Sabaoth's face was starting to redden again.
Grand Admiral Thrawn!
But as to Organa Solo and her twins, Thrawn cut him off smoothly. You can have them whenever you wish.
The embryonic tantrum evaporated.
What do you mean?
Sabaoth demanded warily.
I mean that attacking Coruscant and carrying off Organa Solo by brute force is impractical, Thrawn said. Sending in a small group to kidnap her, on the other hand, is perfectly feasible. I've already ordered intelligence to assemble a commando team for that purpose. It should be ready within the day.
A commando team?
Sabaoth's lip twisted.
Need I remind you how your Nogri have continually failed you in this matter?
I agree, Thrawn said, an oddly grim note to his voice. Which is why the Nogri will not be involved.
Pelion looked down at the Grand Admiral in surprise, then threw an involuntary glance at the door to the command room anteroom, where Thrawn's bodyguard, Rook, was waiting. Ever since the Lord Darth Vader had first duped the Nogri into their perpetual service to the Empire, the gullible gray-skinned aliens had insisted on putting their own personal honor on the line with each mission. Being pulled off an assignment, especially one this important, would be like a slap in the face to them, or worse.
Admiral,
he murmured.
I'm not sure.
We'll discuss it later, Captain, Thrawn said. For now, all I need to know is whether Master Sabaoth is truly ready to receive his young Jedi, one blue-black eyebrow lifted, or whether he prefers simply discussing it.
Sabaoth smiled thinly.
Am I to take that as a challenge, Grand Admiral Thrawn?
Take it any way you like, Thrawn said. I merely point out that a wise tactician considers the cost of an operation before launching it. Organa Solo's twins are due to be born any day now, which means you would have two infants as well as Organa Solo herself to deal with. If you're not certain you can handle that, it would be best to postpone the operation.
Pelion braced himself for another explosion of clone madness, but to his surprise, it didn't come.
The only question, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Sabaoth said softly,
is whether newborn infants will be too much for your Imperial commandos to handle.
Very well, Thrawn nodded. Our rendezvous with the rest of the fleet will be in 30 minutes. You'll transfer to the Death's Head at that time to assist in their attack on Wustri. By the time you return to the Chimera... Again, the eyebrow lifted. We should have your Jedi for you.
Very well, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Sabaoth said. He drew himself up again, smoothing his long white beard away from his robe.
But I warn you, if you fail me this time, you will not be pleased with the consequences.
Turning, he strode across the command room and through the door.
It's always such a pleasure, Thrawn commented under his breath as the door slid shut.
Pelion worked moisture into his mouth.
Admiral, with all due respect...
You're worried about my having promised to get Organa Solo out of possibly the most secure place in Rebellion-held territory, Thrawn said.
Naturally, sir, yes,
Pelion said.
The Imperial Palace is supposed to be an impregnable fortress.
Yes, indeed, Thrawn agreed. But it was the Emperor who made it that way. And as in most things, the Emperor kept a few small secrets about the palace to himself. And to certain of his favorites.
Pelion frowned down at him. Secrets?
Such as a private way in and out?
He hazarded. Thrawn smiled up at him.
Precisely. And now that we can finally ensure that Organa Solo will be staying put in the palace for a while, it becomes profitable to try sending in a commando team.
But not a Nogri team.
Thrawn lowered his eyes to the collection of holographic sculptures surrounding them.
There is something wrong with the Nogri, Captain, he said quietly. I don't yet know what it is, but I know it's there. I can sense it with every communication I have with the Dynasts on Honiger.
Pelion thought back to that awkward scene a month ago, when that painfully apologetic envoy from the Nogri Dynasts had come aboard with the news that the suspected traitor Kabarak had escaped from their custody. So far, despite their best efforts, they had been unable to recapture him.
Perhaps they're still fidgeting over that Kabarak thing, he suggested. And well they should be,
Thrawn said coldly.
But it's more than that. And until I find out how much more, the Nogri will remain under suspicion.
He leaned forward, tapped two controls on his board. The holographic sculptures faded and were replaced by a tactical map of the current position of the major battle planes.
But at the moment, we have two more pressing matters to consider,
he continued, leaning back in his seat again.
First, we have to divert our increasingly arrogant Jedi Master from this mistaken notion that he has the right to rule my empire. Organa Solo and her twins are that diversion.
Pelion thought about all the other attempts to capture Organa Solo.
And if the team fails?
There are contingencies, Thrawn assured him. Despite his power and even his unpredictability, Master Sabaoth can still be manipulated.
He gestured toward the tactical map.
What's even more important right now, though, is that we ensure the momentum of our battle plan. So far, the campaign is reasonably on schedule. The Rebellion has resisted more firmly than anticipated in the Farfin and Dolomar sectors, but elsewhere the target systems have generally bowed to Imperial power.
I wouldn't consider any of the gains all that solid yet,
Pelion pointed out.
Precisely, Thrawn nodded. Each depends on our maintaining a strong and highly visible Imperial presence. And for that, it's vital that we maintain our supply of clones.
He paused. Pelion looked at the tactical map, his mind racing as he searched for the response Thrawn was obviously waiting for him to come up with. The Spa-Arti cloning cylinders, hidden away for decades in the Emperor's private storehouse on Wayland, were about as safe as anything in the galaxy could be. Buried beneath a mountain, protected by an Imperial garrison, and surrounded by hostile locals, its very existence was unknown to anyone except the top Imperial commanders. He froze. Top Imperial commanders. And perhaps...
Mara Jade, he said. She's convalescing on Coruscant. Would she have known about the storehouse?
That is indeed the question, Thrawn agreed. There's a good chance she doesn't. I knew many of the Emperor's secrets, and it still took me a great deal of effort to find Wayland. But it's not a risk we can afford to take.
Pelion nodded, suppressing a shiver. He'd been wondering why the Grand Admiral had chosen an intelligence squad for this mission. Unlike standard commando units, intelligence units were trained in such non-military methods as assassination.
Will a single team be handling both missions, sir? Or will you be sending in two?
One team should be adequate, Thrawn said. The two objectives are well enough interlocked to make that reasonable. And neutralizing Jade does not necessarily mean killing her.
Pelion frowned. But before he could ask what Thrawn had meant by that, the Grand Admiral touched his board, and the tactical holo was replaced by a map of Orus sector.
In the meantime, I think it's time to underline the importance of the Kalaya Sage Lilu for our enemies. Do we have a follow-up report yet from Governor Staffer?
Yes, sir,
Pelion said, pulling it up on his datapad.
Skywalker left at the same time as the decoy shuttle, and is presumed to have followed its vector. If so, he'll reach the Podera system in approximately 30 hours.
Excellent, Thrawn said. He'll undoubtedly report into Coruscant before he reaches Podera's. His subsequent disappearance should go a long way toward convincing them that they've found the conduit for our clone traffic.
Yes, sir,
Pelion said, keeping to himself his doubts as to their chances of actually causing Skywalker to disappear. Thrawn presumably knew what he was doing.
One other thing, sir. There was a second follow-up to Staffer's original report. One that came in under an intelligence encrypt code.
From his aide Fingal, Thrawn nodded. A man with Governor Staffer's casual loyalties practically begs us to assign him a quiet watchdog. Were there any discrepancies with the Governor's report?
Just one, sir. The follow-up gave a complete description of Skywalker's contact. A man Staffer had indicated was one of his own agents. Fingal's description strongly suggests the man was, in fact, Talon Card.
Thrawn exhaled thoughtfully. Indeed. Did Fingal suggest any explanation for Card's presence in Calais?
According to him, there are indications that Governor Staffer has had a private trade arrangement with Card for several years,
Pelion said.
Fingal reports he was going to have the man picked up for questioning, but was unable to find a way to do so that wouldn't have alerted Skywalker.
Yes, Thrawn murmured. Well, what's done is done. And if smuggling was all that was involved, there's no harm. Still, we can't have random smugglers buzzing around our deceptions and perhaps accidentally poking holes in them. And Card has already proved he can be a great deal of trouble. For a moment, Thrawn gazed in silence at the Auras sector map. Then he looked up at Pelion.
But for now, we have other matters to deal with. Prepare a course for the Podaris system, Captain. I want the Chimera there within 40 hours.
He smiled thinly.
And signal the garrison commander that I expect him to have a proper reception prepared by the time we arrive.
Perhaps in 2 or 3 days' time, we'll have an unexpected gift to present to our beloved Jedi Master.
Yes, sir.
Pelion hesitated.
Admiral, what happens if we get Organa Solo and her twins for Sabaoth, and he's able to turn them the way he thinks he can? We'd have 4 of them to deal with instead of just 1. 5 if we're able to capture Skywalker at Podaris.
There's no need for concern, Thrawn said, shaking his head. Turning either Organa Solo or Skywalker would take Sabaoth a great deal of time and effort. It would be even longer before the infants were old enough to be of any danger to us, no matter what he does to them.
Long before any of that occurs, Thrawn's eyes glittered, we'll have come to a suitable arrangement with our Jedi Master over the sharing of power in the Empire. Pelion swallowed.
Understood, sir,
he managed.
Good. Then you're dismissed, Captain. Return to the bridge.
Yes, sir.
Pelion turned and headed across the room, the muscles in his throat feeling tight.
Yes, he understood all right. Thrawn would come to an arrangement with Sabaoth, where he would have the Jedi Master killed. If he could.
It was not, Pelion decided, a confrontation he would like to place any bets on.
Or, for that matter, be anywhere near when it happened.
Chapter 4
Podaris was one of the select group of worlds generally referred to in the listings as marginal. Planets that had remained colonized not because of valuable resources or convenient location, but solely because of the stubborn spirit of its colonists. With a disorienting 10-hour rotational cycle, a lowland slew ecology that had effectively confined the colonists to a vast archipelago of tall mesas and a nearly perpendicular axial tilt that created tremendous winds every spring and autumn, Podaris was not the sort of place wandering travelers generally bothered with. Its people were tough and independent, tolerant to visitors but with a long history of ignoring the politics of the outside galaxy, all of which made it an ideal transfer point for the Empire's new clone traffic. And an ideal place for that same Empire to set a trap. The man shadowing Luke was short and plain, the sort of person who would fade into the background almost anywhere he went. He was good at his job, too, with a skill that implied long experience in Imperial intelligence. But that experience had naturally not extended to trailing Jedi Knights. Luke had sensed his presence almost as soon as the man had begun following him, and had been able to visually pick him out of the crowd a minute later. leaving only the problem of what to do about him.
R2?
Luke called softly into the comlink he'd surreptitiously wedged into the neckband of his hooded robe.
We've got company. Probably Imperials.
There was a soft, worried trill from the comlink, followed by something that was obviously a question.
There's nothing you can do, Luke told him,
taking a guess as to the content of the question, and wishing 3PO was there to translate. He could generally pick up the gist of what R2 was saying, but in a situation like this, the gist might not be enough.
Is there anyone poking around the freighter, or around the landing field in general?
R2 chirped a definite negative. Well, they'll be there soon enough, Luke warned him, pausing to look in a shop window. The tail, he noted, moved forward a few more steps before finding an excuse of his own to stop. A professional, indeed.
Get as much of the pre-flight done as you can without attracting attention. We'll want to get off as soon as I get there.
The droid warbled acknowledgement. Reaching to his neck, Luke shut off the comlink and gave the area a quick scan. The first priority was to lose the tail before the Imperials made any more overt moves against him. And to do that, he needed some kind of distraction. 50 meters ahead in the crowd was what looked to be his best opportunity. Another man striding along the street in a robe of similar cut and color to Luke's. Cautiously picking up his pace, trying not to give the appearance of hurrying, Luke moved toward him. The other robed figure continued to the T-junction ahead and turned the corner to his right. Luke picked up his pace a bit more, sensing as he did so his shadower's suspicion that he'd been spotted. Resisting the urge to break into a flat-out run, Luke strolled casually around the corner. It was a street like most of the others he'd already seen in the city. Wide, rock-paved, reasonably crowded, and lined on both sides with greystone buildings. Automatically, he reached out with the Force, scanning the area around him and as far ahead as he could sense, and abruptly caught his breath. Directly ahead, still distant but clearly detectable, were small pockets of darkness where his Jedi senses could read absolutely nothing, as if the Force that carried the information to him had somehow ceased to exist, or was being blocked. Which meant this was no ordinary ambush for an ordinary New Republic spy. The Imperials knew he was here, and had come to Padaris equipped with Islamari. And unless he did something fast, they were going to take him. He looked again at the buildings around him, squat two-story structures for the most part, with textured facades and decorative roof parapets. Those to his immediate right were built in a single solid row. Directly across the street to his left, the first building after the T-junction had a warped facade, leaving a narrow gap between it and its neighbors. It wasn't much in the way of cover, and the distance itself was going to be a reach, but it was all he had. Hurrying across the street, half expecting the trap to be sprung before he got there, he slipped into the opening. Bending his knees, letting the Force flow into his muscles, he jumped. He almost didn't make it. The parapet directly above him was angled and smooth, and for a second he seemed to hang in midair as his fingers scrabbled for a hold. Then he found a grip, and with a surge of effort pulled himself up and over to lie flat along the rooftop. Just in time. Even as he eased one eye over the edge of the parapet, he saw his tail come racing around the corner, all efforts at subtlety abandoned. Shoving aside those in his way, he said something inaudible into the comlink in his hand. And from the cross street a block away, a row of white armored stormtroopers stepped into view, blaster rifles held high against their chests, the dark elongated shapes of Islamari slung on backpack nutrient frames across their shoulders. They cordoned off the end of the street. It was a well-planned, well-executed net, and Luke had maybe 3 minutes to get across the roof and down before they realized their fish had slipped out of it. Easing back from the edge, he turned his head toward the other side of the roof. The roof didn't have another side. Barely 60 centimeters from where he lay, the roof abruptly became a blank wall that angled steeply downward for perhaps 100 meters, extending in both directions as far as Luke could see. Beyond its lower edge, there was nothing but the distant mists in the lowlands beneath the mesa. He'd miscalculated, possibly fatally. Preoccupied with the man shadowing him,
He'd completely missed the fact that his path had taken him to the outer edge of the mesa. The slanting wall beside him was one of the massive shield barriers designed to deflect the planet's vicious seasonal winds harmlessly over the city. Luke had escaped the Imperial net, only to discover that there was literally nowhere else